I can't believe you asked me that.
You know what I mean?
Everybody, I just been yakking it up with Doug and Don there. Boy, what a couple of characters they are. Jeez, you can always hoot it up with other people from Texas. You know, most people think that those of us from Texas, we all walk around with big hats and belt buckles and boots. We all say y'all, and we eat a lot of chicken fried steak with mashed potatoes and cream gravy, and we're all members of the Baptist Church. Well, wrong. Well, I'm really grateful to be here with you guys. I'm kind of escaping some of the insanity that's been going on around my neck of the woods. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and start the show. Questioning the universe and the purpose of life, the meaning of your existence. Well, this is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon, and you are about to take a walk to the other side. You're not going to stay there, but we are going to walk over there. We're going to take a peek, take a look, broaden our horizons a little bit. On this show, we devote an hour to weeding out the societal dogma that keeps many of us trapped in the fear of physical death. You hear that? Physical death. And it dissuades us from thinking for ourselves when it comes to spirituality. How many of you were raised with canned spirituality? I love that term, canned spirituality. Spoon-fed some form of religion in your youth. Then you got older and you went, I don't know about this. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Maybe you started thinking for yourself. Maybe a clergy person or somebody in your family gave you some grief about that, and it turns you off. Well, if you would like to call in any time during the next hour, dial toll-free 877-876-5227. Or you can email me directly. My computer is up and running again, thank goodness, at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. To learn more about my research into the departing visions of the dying, yes, that topic is researched. Yes, sirree, where visions of the deceased relatives visit the individual preparing to cross over, go to www.carla, Carla, Wills, Brandon, Brandon.com. My website is up. It's free of charge. I'm not hawking anything. It is there for you to go to and get some information. There are articles to read, different things to look at. Some of our greatest traditions, including pop culture, have their origins in deathbed visions, after-death communications, near-death experiences, premonitions, and spiritually transformative visions. Did you know the popular alternative healing technique Reiki therapy was one of these? This blew me away. I just found this out. I wasn't even going to talk about this tonight, but I was having a little chat with a client of mine who is a Reiki therapist, and this person gave me the lowdown on this, and so I thought, you know, I'm gonna educate folks here. Now, for those of you who are Reiki therapists out there, if I say anything wrong, please email me and correct me, because I don't have it all together all of the time. And I'm not the all-encompassing avenue of information. I could always use more information. But Reiki, as many of you know, is a method of natural healing based on the application of universal life force energy. Actually, that's what Reiki means. It's universal life force energy. In the late 1800s, the founder of Reiki, Dr. It's U-S-U-I. Sounds like you pronounce it Usui. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. Was looking for a way to heal using the light of God. This set him on a journey of many years. You ever notice that mystics, they always take these journeys that last many years? Oh, man, with my schedule, I don't think I could take many years to go on a journey. My journey has to be incorporated into my life. One spiritual journey took place on a mountaintop. Remember we talked several weeks ago about the meditation where you visualize yourself sitting on a mountaintop, your higher self, looking down into the valley on that earthbound part of you that's trying to figure out this deal called life. Mountaintops sure do play an important part in most spiritual traditions, don't they? After years of study, he felt that he had to go further, that he required in-depth meditation. So he told the monks at this monastery he intended to fast and meditate for 21 days at a nearby mountain. Well, you know, Jesus fasted. It seems like a lot of mystics, they also fast. I did that once. Once was enough. He told a monk, if I do not come back on the night of the 21st day, on the 22nd morning, send out a search party to find my body. I will be dead. I shall go through this meditation without food, only water. Then off he was going. He traipsed on up that mountain. And as he climbed the mountain, he gathered 21 stones with which to count the days. Each day he would throw away a stone to keep track of time. On the 20th day, there had been no spiritual experience. You know, years ago, I went and traked on up some mountain in Taos, New Mexico, and my husband was with me, and he's an old outward bound guy. He went to high school in Colorado, where they dump him in some desert for 2 weeks and leave him there with a week's supply of food, and he was supposed to learn how to survive. But he and I, we midnight traipsed on out, Taos, New Mexico, went on up this mountain, past some Indian graveyard. It was very dramatic. And I sat there and I grieved and I cried and I talked to my higher self. And my husband, he fell asleep on a rock. I guess he was meditating. On the 20th day, there had been no spiritual experience. And as he threw away the last stone, he said to himself, well, this is it. Either I get the answer tonight or I do not. That night, in the night in the distance, he could see a ball of light suddenly coming toward him. His first thought was to get out of the way. That makes sense, doesn't it? Get out of the way. But then he thought this might just be what he was waiting for. Standing still, he allowed the ball of light to hit him right in the forehead. I had an experience like that years ago when I was studying with Raymond Moody, when my deceased relatives came to visit me, and they came in the form of energy, swirling light, and when they touched me and they passed through me, it was such an awesome experience. It was a loving, touching experience. I wonder if this was that. As it struck him, he was taken on a journey and shown bubbles of all the colors of the rainbow. And these bubbles were what were eventually to become the symbols of Reiki. These very same symbols were also in the Tibetan writings he had been studying, but had been unable to understand. From an essay on the history of Reiki, we continue to read. Millions and millions of bubbles danced before him, then moved to his left. He counted 7 colors. I was blessed today, he said. A great white light came from his right. Golden symbols appeared. This is quite the spiritually transformative experience, isn't it? One after another, they radiated out in front of him, like on a movie screen, as if to say, remember, remember. As he watched them, there was total understanding. Have you ever had that experience where you have some universal experience where you have a sudden, incredible connectedness with the entire universe? And for a moment, you're given the keys to the kingdom, and you understand the meaning of your life, and you burst out laughing because it's so simple. Well, it sounds like this is what happened to this guy. He then dusted himself off, picked up his cane and his straw hat, then took the first steps of his 25-mile track to Kyoto. The Zen monks were expecting him at the temple by sundown, and he was surprised that he hadn't died of starvation, and he didn't feel hungry anymore. This was indeed a miracle, he thought. Near the foot of the mountain, he stubbed a big toe on a rock. The blow lifted the toenail. Blood spurted out. Now, that's not a real good image there. The pain thumped with his heartbeat. He He sat down and he held the toe in his hands. The pain subsided. The bleeding stopped. He continued to hold it till there was no more pain. Then he looked at the toe and he was amazed and delighted to see the nail was back in its normal position. There was no indication of injury except for dried blood. This was indeed a second miracle, he thought. On the trip back, he healed the ailing tooth of a young girl by placing his hands on her face. Now, what does this sound like, you guys? Doesn't this sound like some of the healings that we have heard with regard to other mystics throughout history? I don't know. I'll let you guys think about who that might be. This was his third miracle in one day. In exchange for the healing, the girl's uncle gave him some food. He ate heartily, though he did not get sick after breaking a 21-day fast. These are known as Dr. Usu's first four miracles. Once back at the Zen temple, he healed a monk who had been suffering from arthritis and backache. He wanted to use these abilities to help others, so he spent the next 7 years in the beggar section of Tokyo, healing the poor and sick people there, sending them to a priest to assist finding them employment and elevating them out of poverty. Now, here is somebody who really found the purpose of his life. He traveled around teaching and healing, working both with the spiritual healing as well as physical healing. Have you all come up with some names of other mystics who have done these things? After he passed on, his cohort became the leader of Reiki. This individual opened a clinic in Tokyo near the Imperial Palace. It consisted of 8 beds in a large room and 2 practitioners, 2 patients. Where on earth would we find that today? I can't even get a nurse to take my temperature when I go to see the doctor. One would treat the head and the other would be on the right treating the stomach area. Then both would treat the patient's back. The practitioners all worked here doing healing. They would also go to the homes of the sick and for house calls. To become a Reiki practitioner in that time, one had to be accepted by the masters of the Reiki organization. And second, they had to promise to use Reiki daily and volunteer some hours to practice Reiki regularly in the clinic. What? They're providing a service for no fee? Oh my goodness sakes! That's amazing, what a concept! So the art of Reiki therapy began on a mountaintop. Now, let me tell you something about Reiki real quick. I'm a survivor of some pretty nasty abuse and trauma. And I did an awful lot of healing with Reiki. It's a wonderful, wonderful alternative practice. And as a shrink, I'm going to tell you that if you're seeing a mental health professional and you're just doing talk therapy, you're throwing your money down the toilet. It's a waste of time. You really need to be doing some body work along with your therapy. So if you have any history of trauma, abuse, rape, sexual assault, physical abuse, anything of that nature, if you're PTSD, if you were damaged in a war situation, any physical damage to the body, if you're going to a therapist and you're just doing talk therapy, got to do some body work. Go find a Reiki master. Go find a Reiki therapist. So the art of Reiki therapy, yeah, it began on a mountaintop. How many of you have wanted to get to the top, and how far are you willing to go to get to the top? Now, this is leading into something else. I read something that turned my stomach. I mean, it literally turned my stomach. I couldn't believe what I was reading. Here's a spiritual question for you. Would you leave a dying man or woman alone if you knew they were dying? I want you to really think about this, and probably your first answer is absolutely not. If you were driving down the freeway in the middle of a desert with no one around, with limited gas and water, and you came upon a wreck, would you stop knowing this might jeopardize your water, your safety in the desert? I bet the majority of you would say, heavens, yes. Actually, Michael and I, we did this years ago. We came across a couple who, they were in the middle of a desert, and there was a broken back, and it was a tragic situation, and we were low on gas, and we hoisted these poor folks into the car, and put the pedal to the metal and zipped on to the hospital. It took us several hours. But, yeah, I mean, I think that most of you would do that. I've actually been in this situation on a number of occasions. So here's my questions. What's up with these young climbers who tackle Mount Everest? What's the deal here? According to a May 24th Associated Press news article out of New Zealand, Sir Hillary said Wednesday he was shocked that dozens of climbers left a British mountaineer to die during their own attempts on the world's tallest peak. David Sharp, 34, died apparently of oxygen deficiency while descending from the summit during a solo climb last week. Now, I'm sure you guys read this, but I just really can't get this out of my craw here. More than 40 climbers are thought to have seen him as he lay there dying, and almost all continue to the summit without offering assistance. What is the deal here? Human life is far more important than just getting to the top of a mountain. How many of you know folks out there who will stomp on anybody just to get that 15 minutes of fame or make that extra buck? Newsflash, gang, that's not what it's all about. Absolutely. Hillary was quoted as saying in an interview with New Zealand's Press Association, "This is terrible." New Zealander Mark Inquis, who became the first double amputee to reach the mountain summit on prosthetic legs, told Television New Zealand that his party stopped during its May 15th summit push and found Sharp close to death. Do you know what is an absolute honor for me? I find it an incredible honor to be with somebody who is dying. If I am powerless over the fact that they are passing on and moving on, but I am there, it is my duty to be there with them, unless they specifically tell me they want to die alone, because I've had that happen too, where I've been with somebody who's having incredible deathbed visions. They're talking to their Aunt Susie and their mom and their sisters and their brothers, and it's a whole party in the room, and they're just itching to get over there on the other side, and they will turn to me. I've had them turn to me and say, "You can go now." It's like, well, okay, I can go now. You can go now. But to leave somebody on a mountain to die. A member of the party tried to give Sharp oxygen and sent out a radio distress call before continuing to the summit. But he left him. He left this guy behind. Several parties reported seeing Sharp in various states of health and working on his oxygen equipment on the day of his death. But they left him in order to get to the top. What does this say about our society? This man, who was due to arrive back in New Zealand on Thursday, said Sharp had no oxygen when he found him. He said there was virtually no hope, no hope, that Sharp could have been carried to safety from his position about 1,000 feet short of the 29,000-foot summit inside the low-oxygen death zone of the mountain straddling Nepal-China border. I'm just mortified. I am absolutely mortified. His own party was able to render only limited assistance and had to put the safety of its own members first. Yeah, on the way up the damn mountain. I walked past David, but only because there were far more experienced and effective people than myself to help him. It was a phenomenally extreme environment. It was an incredibly cold day. The temperature was minus 100 at 7 a.m. on the summit, he said. Yes, and he walked by, leaving a man alone to die. Hillary and his partner in 1953 became the first mountaineers to reach Everest summit. Hillary said in an interview published Wednesday in the New Zealand newspaper that some climbers today did not care about the welfare of others. Ditto. There have been a number of occasions when people have been neglected and left to die, and I don't regard this as a correct philosophy, he told the Daily Times. I think the whole attitude toward climbing Mount Everest has become rather horrifying. The people just want to get to the top, he told the newspaper. He said he would have abandoned his own pioneering climbing to save another's life. It was wrong if there was a man suffering altitude problems and was huddled under a rock just to lift your hat and say good morning and pass on by. Go Hillary. He said that his expedition would never for a moment have left one of the members or a group of members just to lie there and die while they plunged on towards the summit. Three climbers from Brazil, Russia, and France have also died. You know, I mean, that really does say a lot about our society. It just, there it is in a nutshell. Last week, another climber was left to die. His climbing crew just left him as he continued on up the mountain. Left him to die as they headed for their own success. An American climber spotted the Australian man, put together a rescue team, and got him down the mountain, and he is currently doing well. In our society, do we absolutely positive, do we need to trample on the physical and emotional well-being of others to get to the top? I certainly hope not. To be top dog ain't what it's cracked up to be, trust me. I made a decision years ago to change my lifestyle, to revamp my life, my philosophy on money, my philosophy on what's important, my philosophy on what is spiritually important to me, radically changed. Speaking of egos, out only for themselves. After the show 2 weeks ago, I made again, smack me, the mistake of turning on the proverbial boob tube. What am I going to learn? On MSNBC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann, I was confronted with total self-will run riot. Okay, when I was a kid, you guys, my grandfather was mayor of the city I grew up in. He was also a Teamster, and he got himself into a tad bit of trouble with the mob. When Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, disappeared, I was living with my grandparents, and the fear was very real. The police, can you imagine this? Even I look back on it, and it's pretty surreal. The police guarded me at school, and they took me to work, and they sat in front of our house and unmarked cars. The phones were tapped, and I wasn't allowed to open the front door. Though this would make for interesting discussion, we're going to blow it off because I need to get on a soapbox about this Countdown story. Olbermann, to help decipher this latest attempt to find Mr. Hoffa, I'm joined by the founding publisher, drumroll please, of Skeptic Magazine and the executive director of the Skeptic Society, Michael Shermer, my pal and yours. So there are 40 to 50 FBI guys searching this horse farm to try to find Hoffa's body. Given that every other tip of this nature, and there have been dozens of them, has turned out to be nothing, why is this one so different? Shermer, well, it is a big waste of everybody's time and money, but it's bigger in people's minds because Jimmy Hoffa was a big character. If it was Joe Schmo, who's missing, and there's a lot of them, nobody seems to care. But in this case, we know who we're looking for. We're live on the air right now. Sorry about that. So we're looking for conspiracy theories that match the size of the character. Okay, for those of you who don't know who this guy slams anybody who does any paranormal research. As soon as the research is put out there, this guy, he almost falls over himself trying to put information out there that shreds it. So, what's going on? Is Mr. Hoffa in the room there with you? This is Keith Olbermann. Well, we got to give him some credit. It is his job to make fun. Shermer, it seems like a conspiracy, doesn't it? But I actually know who killed Hoffa and where he's buried. You want the secrets? Yes, please, Keith says. He was killed by this union of albino monks. Oh, boy, isn't that creative? That were furious about their rights that they didn't get. And so I think he's buried in the Louvre. And you can tell this because if you are looking at the picture of the Last Supper, the character, Mary Magdalene, she's whispering to Jimmy Hoffa. Well, you know, Daniel Brown is getting a lot of press right now for his book, and there's lots of spin-off because of that. There's the Jesus Papers, which is a very interesting book. If you guys haven't picked it up, pick it up. It's there's some interesting stuff in there. Several authors have written about Mary Magdalene finally dispelling the myth that she was a prostitute. Just all of these wonderful theories that are giving the rest of us who don't go for canned religion, you know, giving us a chance to take a look at some refreshing possibilities. And so this guy, of course, has got to jump on his horse, his black horse, and start poo-pooing everything. So, of course, Olbermann makes fun and says that, you know, well, Hoffa is buried under Giant Stadium, or he's been boiled and his fat's been used to redo car seats or something. But here's the part that really got me. Yeah, well, you would think the psychics would tell us he's buried in the woods because that's usually what they say. Now, how did we get to the psychics? By the way, why can't psychics tell us where Jimmy Hoffa's buried? Okay, all of my hair stood up on the back of the neck, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Or the psychics who talk to the dead, why can't they just ask him where he's buried? But you know, we never get answers to questions like this. The reason it's like that is because for the same reason that we want to find a giant, huge conspiracy against who killed JFK, rather than, you know, look at the fact that it's some lone nut assassin. Well, personally, I don't think it was a lone nut assassin. I think that there was more to it than that. Having grown up in the mob, I've got my own theories. We want something to match, cognitively balanced, be balanced, to match the size of the event. So the idea of 9/11, that 9/11 could have been pulled off by 19 hijackers, doesn't seem to match. What on earth is he talking about? That is a horrible, awful event in our history. That was big. It was horrible. It was horrific, and lots of people died. We want a huge, giant conspiracy. Oh, please, give me, you know, let me breathe. And researching this guy, I researched this guy a number of years ago because I almost ended up on a TV show with him, and I found out something very interesting. Not only does he blast paranormal every time he gets a chance, but there's a real reason for this. In his media interviews, when confronted with the hits mediums, real mediums, get in readings, in psychic readings, when confronted by researchers like Gary Schwartz, who scientifically investigate mediums under controlled situations, measuring correct answers versus incorrect answers with sitters they cannot see, guess what Sherman's patent answer is? Another drum roll, please. Oh, I wish I had a drum in here. Shermer's responds again and again with his main objection to psychic phenomena is, where's Jimmy Hoffa? I found out this is like a patent answer of his. This is what he always says in every media situation. He wants to know why the psychics haven't found Jimmy Hoffa, and now he's asking where Osama is. I also discovered something else, something which totally explains Sherman's determined behavior, determined need to slice and dice anything that has to do with life after death. Several personal tales about him can be found in one of his books from his days as a student and an evangelical Christian. This also includes, there's information about his mother's death and his anger towards alternative medicine. I'll leave that with you. In my dealings with hardcore atheists, I have found two common threads. Unresolved anger towards some form of fundamentalist-based organized religion, also God, any concept of God, and also unresolved grief and anger regarding the death of a loved one. I have found this time after time after time again. What happens is this unresolved anger is then channeled into a self-righteous passion against anything spiritual in nature. So, I'm an intellect. I have a loved one. They died. God didn't save her or him. The messages from the church didn't pan out. Religion backfired for me. So as opposed to doing my grief work, I'm going to hold my anger hostage, and I'm going to hold the church hostage. I'm going to hold the synagogue hostage. I'm going to hold principles of spirituality hostage and go on a crusade to prove that all of this is bunk. That way, as long as I'm angry, I don't have to feel how devastated I am that my loved one has moved on and that I don't know how to reach out and touch them anymore. The intellect rules the day, and those of us who explore spirituality are looked upon as uneducated, superstitious idiots. I think this is very, very sad. If people really knew what was going on, when Penn and Teller get out there and do their show and poo-poo anything that has to do with paranormal, the first thing I think is, okay, what is in your family of origin history? What happened to you? Why are you so angry? To learn more about the Skeptical Inquirer, and I think that everybody should go take a peek, and its hardcore skeptical editor, Michael Shermer, plug the Skeptical Inquirer into your search engine. Go to their message board. Oh, my goodness sakes. What you will quickly see is that these skeptics are hell-bent on dissing any alternative medicine or form of spirituality that crosses their path. Reiki doesn't have a leg to stand on as far as they're concerned. Paranormal contact, poo. We're all nuts. And they use the so-called scientific method for doing this. Spirituality is very difficult to quantify, gang. It's not that easy. You can't, like, pour it into a test tube and measure it. But educated fellows like Shermer continue to try. They continue to try only to diss it. But then, of course, there are my buddies like Jeffrey Long and Bruce Grayson and Raymond Moody and Jan Holden, some of these people who they really, really work hard at researching this stuff and taking a look at it as best they can, and they do some great stuff. Speaking of intellectuals, here is an interesting news item. This is the last one, and then we're going to move on to automatic writing. Ghostly syllables for a new degree. If you were to ask anyone what fascinates them, you can guarantee that the one thing that they would all like an answer to is there life after death? This was a quote made by Tony Lawrence. He is the one who was interviewed for this article. People out there are having interesting experiences, and no one is really following up on them. So Dr. Lawrence decided to put together an educational program on how to study intellectually the paranormal. It is less about Hammer House of Horrors and more about proper methodology. The course also looks at people's interest in the spiritual and paranormal as seen on television, in films, and in books. It promises an honest, open, systematic examination of the evidence for these exceptional human experiences. Students will use yoga and meditation to extend or enhance their personal development. Dr. Lawrence said, a lot of what we will be controversial yet thought-provoking. There is always a fascination with the unknown, and we will be exploring the paranormal and trying to explain why things happen, but sometimes there won't be answers. If you were to ask anyone what fascinates them, you can guarantee that the one thing they would all like to hear about is, can we contact our loved ones? Is there some sort of existence after this? Scientifically speaking of the educated, really scientifically investigating the mystical, how many of you know that it is this guy's hope that a master's degree of science course in parapsychology will evolve? And what will happen is that individuals will write doctorates on paranormal subjects. So anyway, I thought that was very interesting. Okay. Now let's get on with the fun part of our show. I'm done screaming and yelling for a while. How many of you know that psychotherapists such as myself have been using automatic writing as a clinical tool for a number of decades? Bunches of us use it. I first started using automatic writing years ago as a means of accessing unconscious material in patients. Now, of course, Michael Shermer would disagree with me and tell me that I was planting information in my patients' minds. No, there is a real technique for accessing a client's individual information, bringing trauma to the surface, be it sexual abuse or tragedy in Vietnam. Automatic writing is a true blue method for tapping into memories which were once considered lost forever. In doing this work, periodically I have had patients suddenly inform me that they are receiving messages from departed relatives. And I'm going to tell you something. Initially, it spooks them a little bit, but this actually becomes a foundation for their future spiritual development. I have no right as a clinician to force my spiritual views on anybody, to force my religion on anybody. That is not my job. But when this sort of thing does come up, what I do try to do is be supportive. And boy, I've heard some wild stuff. And you know what? These contacts, if somebody comes in and they have horrific, horrible abuse, and they're very angry with spiritual principles, and they have a spiritual experience like this, it takes them totally by surprise, but in the end, it becomes a very healing experience for them. As the author of 10 books, I know how curious the art of writing can become. There have been moments, gang, when I've written something very profound and then wondered, now where on earth did that come from? And I know there are some of you out there who have had these experiences. Several years ago, I received an email from a friend who told me that medium Susie Smith, author of the Afterlife Codes, write that down, the Afterlife Codes, had crossed over. She was 90-something. She was in a wheelchair. So, you know, I mean, her passing, it wasn't a total shock, but I have to tell you, I was really, really saddened. She and I used to exchange emails constantly. We had corresponded over a number of years, and I have really grown to look forward to hearing from her. She's a very interesting person. She made 90 look good. She made 90 look cool. As I sat in front of my computer thinking about her, realizing that this was why she hadn't been returning my email, I had an incredible after-death communication vision of her flying through this beautiful star-lit dark blue midnight sky shouting, "I am free! I am free!" Now, I have to tell you something. I did not know she had become wheelchair-bound. And she was dancing, and she was flying, and she was just ecstatic. And this was someone who actually was looking forward to passing. For as long as I had known her, also, I had never known her to shout. So this vision took me totally by surprise. But intuitively, I knew this was her way of letting me know that she was happy that she had been released from her body. I mean, as you know, discussing this, I can see it vividly in my mind. Dr. Gary Schwartz often talks about his involvement with Susie. The two of them were very, very tight. Susie was scientifically tested by Dr. Schwartz, and he found that her readings with individuals she did not know or could not see had more hits than misses. After her death, Schwartz actually had a series of unusual experiences himself, substantiating the accuracy of medium reports from the other side. Susie not only wrote 30 books, geez, I'm a baby, I've only written 10, about the afterlife and paranormal, but this one-time professional newspaper woman began her paranormal journey, her personal paranormal journey, with automatic writing. And she used to tell me about it. She used to tell me about how she would sit down and how she would, you know, she would start writing and she'd lay it all out for me. I remember her telling me how she made contact with her deceased mother through automatic writing. And it was something she really, really believed in, and she passed on techniques in her writings to other people. Now, according to, of course, the Skeptic's Dictionary, automatic writing or trans writing is also a therapeutic technique, allegedly, I love the way they use allegedly, is directed by a spirit or by the unconscious mind. It is sometimes called trance writing because it is done quickly. When people who use trance writing, automatic writing, as a way of communicating with the other side, what you'll see if you sit with someone, a medium who does that, they don't even look down at what it is they're writing. They just start writing. It's done quickly and without judgment, and whatever comes to mind without consciousness, as if in a trance, is written down. It is believed that this allows one to tap into the subconscious mind where the true self dwells. Personally, I think it's the higher self, and I think the higher self is able to make contact with realms that we, in our very limited physical state, can't get access to easily. Trans writing is also used by some psychotherapists, yeah, like yours truly, who think it's a quick way to release repressed memories. There is no scientific evidence that trance writing has any therapeutic value. That's garbage. It's total garbage. It's a way to connect with the self. And it is. It's a way to connect with the spiritual self. Advocates of automatic writing claim that the process allows them to access other entities for information and guidance. They further claim that it permits them to recall previously irretrievable data from the subconscious mind. You know, I have lots and lots of clients who they will come in and they have all of the symptoms of somebody who has been horribly, horribly injured, hurt. Maybe they are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence to the Iraqi war or some sort of rape incidents, and the mind is, I've said to you guys over and over again, the mind will dissociate itself from these experiences. Automatic writing, different writing techniques can be used to trigger memory. And in some situations, some people are able to take it a little bit farther. They take it beyond the subconscious. Skeptics consider automatic writing to be little more than a parlor game. These guys are such scaredy pants. They're such big babies. Although sometimes useful for self-discovery and for getting started on a writing project, while it is likely that many unconscious desires and ideas are expressed with automatic writing, it is unlikely that they are any more profound than one's conscious notions. There is no more evidence that the true self is in the unconscious than there is that the true self is revealed while drunk or in a psychotic break. Okay, enough of that baloney. I've had enough. But what I want you to listen to now is this is the account coming from a medium, and what she shares with us is how she started doing automatic writing and how it led her. How automatic writing not only got her in contact with the other side, but it moved her into other avenues of spirituality, spiritually transformative experiences. Her name is Irma Slag. When my mother Sophie died of a sudden heart attack in her Philadelphia, Pennsylvania home, my own life seemed to end as well. This was not my first experience with death. There had been other deaths. The only grandparent I knew, my mother's mother, was gone. Three of my mother's brothers were gone. A few close friends, gone. People I worked with, I knew death. I regarded it as the end of their learning experience on Earth and the end of our learning experience with them. That's how so many people feel. I felt sad for their family and friends, but after a few days, I would go on with living. I will miss you. Goodbye. But I couldn't say goodbye to my mother, my mom, always there for me, always a supportive friend, always so gentle, so strong, always so firm, yet considerate and thoughtful and forgiving. I wept until I couldn't cry anymore. I wore sunglasses to hide my red, weary eyes when I was forced to leave the house. For days after the funeral, I couldn't get dressed. I didn't want her to be gone. I found it impossible to be comforted. I moped and prayed and sat around the house. It was while sitting in my living room alone in my own darkness that I suddenly felt the need to pick up a pen, then a paper. I started to write the capital letter G. It was curved in a very round, a very artistic and distinctively creative way. We each have our own way of writing the letters of the alphabet. This was definitely not the way I would form the capital letter G. When I went to my mother's house to help my dad the following weekend, the strange written letter G was last in my thoughts. I was cleaning my dad's kitchen when my eyes were drawn to a cork board my mother had hanging on the wall for phone messages. It was near the phone, not far from the kitchen sink where I was standing. for some unknown reason, I had put the paper of capital letter G's I had written in my pants pocket. I pulled it out and matched it to the writing on the chalkboard. The G on the board and the G on the paper in my hand were written exactly the same. Excitement filled my body as I called to my husband, who was in the next room. Do you notice that when you have a true blue spiritual experience, you know. You just know. You know something is up. Something's going on. Something's happening. Ted, I called. He came running as if from the tone of my voice something was terribly wrong. What is it? Look at this. I tried to control the excitement in my voice. The G I showed you last night and the G written on this paper by my mother are exactly the same. He took a closer look at the writing on the paper in my hand and then at the paper on the wall. They are the same. Look at the way the G is sort of rounded at the top, but then squares off. He looked again. They are the same. Well, I was almost jumping with excitement. My husband appeared shaken, a little less color in his face, and a great deal of concern for both our sanities. Typical response when you first have a spiritual encounter with the other side. There is this sense of, am I losing my mind? Is this for real? Is this really happening? What do you think of that, I asked. I don't know. It is the same, that's for sure, he stated reluctantly. It must be my mother trying to tell me she can use my hands to form letters. It seems so. My husband was a skeptic back then and didn't want to believe that my mom was contacting me. I actually believe it frightened him. When we get home, I'm going to try again. Later that night, I got a piece of paper. Okay, now listen, you guys. I got a piece of paper and a pencil, sat down on a comfortable chair at my kitchen table, paper in front of me, pencil in hand, and immediately the pen began to move. I watched in astonishment. Hi, Irma. I'm glad you understood the message from the capital letter G. That was you writing with my hand? Yes. There was no doubt that the person was my mother. I don't know how I knew. I just felt it. Are you all right? I asked. Yes, she said. Everyone here is loved. It is so beautiful. Don't worry about your dad. He'll be fine. It makes me sad to see him walking around that big house by himself. Tears came to my eyes. I was very worried about my dad. Dependent on my mother for so many years, they had just celebrated their 40th wedding anniversary. He'll be fine, my mother wrote again. We spoke for a few minutes more. Mom, is there anything you can tell me that will prove that this is really you? The pencil wrote, I took care of the dolls you had as a child. I bought them new shoes and socks. I washed their dresses. Take them home with you. Don't leave them in your dad's house. I will, I promised. I spoke out loud. I sat back in my chair. I felt so relaxed as though I had taken a nap. I stared at the writing on the paper. The handwriting was not mine. My handwriting is much smaller and bolder. The writing on the paper was shaky, irregular, and all the words ran together. Now, I will tell you that when I have gone to mediums who work with automatic writing and have had a reading done, what I have gotten back is writing where all the words run together. And so either the medium goes through or I've had to go through and separate out the words. I had to make notes so that I could remember some of my questions and fit them into answers. I didn't know at the time, but writing through the pencil in this way is called automatic writing. Since then, I've read many books on it. Many people can do it and are not aware of their ability. Later that week, I went to the house, okay, now listen, gang, that my parents shared. I was supposed to meet my dad. She was supposed to meet her dad to take him to the dentist. I entered an empty house. I looked upstairs and downstairs for my dad or a note or something. There was nothing. I had forgotten about taking the dolls, feeling I could take them any time. But then, remembering, since my dad wasn't home, I found myself suddenly aware of being drawn to the smallest bedroom where the dolls were put after my mom's death. I stood at the door staring at the dolls. They were not in good order, as my mother would have left them. They were lying in disarray. One was thrown on his side, one was on his face, on his desk. The doll's wigs were off. Another had a foot in the air, almost off the table, shoes off. No wonder it was so important that my mother wanted me to take them to my house. Someone I never found out who had thrown my mother's precious memorabilia into a state of chaos. It was important to her that I bring them to my house and take care of them as she had. I took the three dolls and put them carefully in my car. That done, I went back to my house. Immediately the phone rang. It was my dad. "Irma," he said, "the strangest thing just happened. I got in my car to come home and it wouldn't start. I waited a few minutes and then it started. That's why I'm late. My dad's car wouldn't start. Then, after I took the dolls outside to the car, came back to the house, my dad's car started. I felt myself shiver. Without those few minutes to myself, I wouldn't have had time to put nor the inclination to find the dolls, put them in my car, and take them home. Something that meant so much to my mother. I no longer have to use, okay, listen, automatic writing. I can hear words and I can hear my mother's voice in my head. My mom knows my feelings and she is grasping my feelings. I am not forgetting. I can also now hear spirits with my mind. I can hear their voices, their emotions, their concerns. This is what happened with Susie Smith. She started out doing automatic writing, and then what happened is that it moved into other paranormal activity. In the early evening of June 1984, I was finishing up the dinner dishes and the phone rang. It was my friend Carol. "Can you talk?" "Yes, what is it?" I said. I entered my upstairs bedroom and the aroma of my grandmother's perfume was in the air. Remember we talked about that? After-death communications where we'll be visited with the scent of a loved one. I lived in this house for 5 years and it never happened before. It had never happened. "What was the fragrance?" I asked. "The old-fashioned smell of flowers that my grandmother always used in her bedroom. I had a feeling of peace, and it took me back to a time when I was a child in her house." We were both silent for a few moments. "By putting the familiar aroma in your bedroom, your grandmother wants to give you a message. She's here now. I'll call you back as soon as we're finished talking." So Irma is now able to visit with spirits without using automatic writing. "I am able to make contact with spirits I don't know. I am also able to make contact with an identifiable departed person at the request of some living person. Only that is if the departed person wants to be contacted. For those of you who are grieving out there, why can't I make contact with my mother or my father or my brother or my lover or my husband or my wife? Maybe there's a reason. Carol's grandmother I knew had an important message for her. I first asked the spirit for information that only the two people involved could know. A tender moment of joy or sorrow, a memory that no one else knew. This is to prove to the living person that the spirit is, in fact, their loved one. I also write the message on paper to make sure it is accurate and not my interpretation of what is said. I called Carol back about 45 minutes later. She answered the phone. "What happened? Your grandmother was here." "What did she say?" "First, she spoke about your appendix attack when you were a child. It is to prove to you that she was really here." "My appendix attack? What did she tell you happened?" I pulled out the paper because I had not known.
It's just past the top of the hour?
Pardon me?
It's past the top of the hour?
How much farther do you want me to go?
Oh, how about another 5 minutes?
That's good.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. I read from the paper. She had the attack in her mother's house on Thanksgiving. She could not eat dinner. She was taken to the hospital. "I had dinner first," she said. Whoa, wait a second. Yes, my mother and my dad took me to the hospital. My grandmother stayed home to give dinner to everyone else. She was on the verge of tears. "What else did she say?" I read from the paper. "I don't want to hurt my granddaughter, upset her, but I have to tell her, my daughter, her mother will die soon. I'll be there when Carol's mother leaves her body, and I will welcome her to the other side. She's not to worry. Her mother will be with me." "I had a feeling it would be bad news," Carol said. At the time of the message was given, her mother wasn't sick. Her grandmother was right, though, about the appendix attack. She did not want her to be right about her mother's forthcoming death. 2 months later, Carol called to say her mother had suddenly taken ill. Her mother did die shortly after this. So, I mean, that's kind of a heavy-duty example of automatic writing, but automatic writing is something that you can do. It's something that you can do right now. And all you have to do is do as Susie Smith did, do as Irma did. You find a quiet spot without distractions. You sit comfortably. Take a few moments to clear your mind, unplug the phone, turn off the TV, turn off the radio. Just touch the pen or pencil to the paper. Also, have a box of crayons by your side, because sometimes we'll suddenly want to pick up crayons. Try not to consciously think about anything. Don't control this process. Do not look at the paper. If you need to, close your eyes. If it doesn't happen right away, give yourself a break and try again tomorrow night. Give yourself 2 weeks, one night after the other. In addition to letters and numbers, you might find yourself drawing. You can also ask questions of those that you are wanting to make contact with. Well, gang, I've been given the heads up that it's time for me to move on. As usual, it's been a blast hanging out with you. Please do try the automatic writing. If you have some success, will you please email me at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net or go to the TNT website at BBS Radio blog and service and go ahead and write out your experience. In 2 weeks, we will be talking about trusting your premonitions. Now, for some of you worrywart mothers who worry about your kids and think that they're going to be, you know, if they take off for the weekend, that they're going to end up dead on the side of the road, welcome to my club. That's called the Jewish Mother Syndrome. That's not what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about certain types of premonitions where we have that aha experience after the premonition comes true. So in 2 weeks, join me for the weird and offensive news of the day. We'll take a look at those who are still trying to slam paranormal activities that you and I enjoy investigating. And then what we'll do is we'll spend some time looking at premonitions. For now, this is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon wishing you a pleasant evening, a deep, deep sleep, and wonderful dreams. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.